So the reason why we're interested in DNA packing in bacteriophages is because it's a very simple system in which we can study how DNA is organized in different organisms. So probably you've seen these pictures before, but it tells you how DNA is organized in E. coli and how DNA is organized in the human nucleus. So just to have an idea on the level of condensation that these molecules have to undergo in order to fit within these organisms, for instance, for the E. coli, the length of the genome is about 10 to the 3 microns, and it has to fit in a bacterium, which is about 1 micron. So you need a linear reduction of 10 to the 3. I'm not going to get into the volume reduction today, but that's the idea. The main way this is, or at least 50% of this condensation, goes by plectonemic supercoiling. The other 50% might be through solenoidal supercoiling. But it's still kind of up in the air. For human, for instance, the level of condensation is higher. We're talking about the length of 10 to the 6 microns, and it has to fit in a 10 micron container, the diameter. So this implies a reduction of 10 to the 5. So it's really, this condensation is large, and it's even larger if you think that a lot of biological events have to be happening with this condensation, let's say transcription, repair, and so on and so forth, and replication. So bacteriophages, to some extent, provide a very simple system to study these problems. This is the structure of a bacteriophage. Bacteriophages have this head over here called capsid. They may contain DNA or RNA inside. These ones contain double-stranded DNA. Then they have this piece over here that is called the connector, and it's also used to basically thread the DNA in, pack the DNA in this capsid. And I'll show you a figure in a minute. And this is the tail, and these are the tail fibers. The tail fibers are used to recognize the cellular wall of the bacterium that they are going to infect. And the tail is used mainly to push the DNA out once the cell has been recognized. During morphogenesis, interestingly, bacteriophages form their capsid first, so they form this procapsid. These are the proteins of the capsid, and these are some what are called scaffolding proteins that are used to hold the capsid in place. And then the DNA is threading through this vertex over here, as is shown in here. So the DNA threads in. At the same time, these scaffolding proteins get out, and eventually all the DNA is packed in this fashion. For what we are interested in our system, we know that one of these ends is going to be attached close to the entry or the exit of the DNA. We don't know exactly what is happening with the other. But this is kind of an important slide to remember for the talk. Okay, so that slide didn't quite show the complexity of the problem. And here is an electron micrograph of, this is the bacteriophage, this is the tail, and this is the DNA that has been kind of extracted from the phage. So it's been measured that the DNA inside the bacteriophage is under about 70 or 80 atmospheres of pressure, and the concentration is 0.8 micrograms per mil. So it's very, very high concentration. Why are we interested in this, besides what I said before about they provide kind of the basic properties for DNA packing? They also serve as models for DNA packing in herpes viruses, which are a lot nastier than bacteriophages. They also serve as models for different bacteriophages. So here I put P even, meaning P2, P4, P22, lambda, Phi29, T2, T4, and so on. And they also serve as models for the lipo-DNA complexes that are used in gene therapy. So they, presumably, if we understand how the DNA is packed and or is organized in these systems, we'll get some information from these other more complicated systems. So the approach that we took was following some experiments that were done by Richard Callendar and Jim Wang. And the idea from these experiments was to take this bacteriophage and create a tailless mutant. So it's basically a bacteriophage that doesn't have the tail. These bacteriophages are not able to infect. And then when they extracted DNA from these bacteriophages, then they saw that there were knots in here. These knots were used mainly for topoisomerase action, so they never bothered to interrogate these knots about any particular properties of bacteriophages. So we took this project at this point and said, well, can we actually ask these knots something about how the DNA is sitting inside the bacteriophage? Now, the form. So this is what I just said. So our goal is to see if we can get any information about how the DNA is organized. So I'm going to tell you today two stories. One that I'm going to start with this one. We see the knots, and we try to reconstruct how the DNA is sitting inside the capsid. And the second story is, if we assume a particular packing model, as other people have proposed, let's see what would be the characterization, the type of knots that this packing model would produce. Okay, so these are the two parts of the talk. The reason why there are knots is simple. This molecule enters as a linear molecule, but then even though it's double-stranded DNA all the way from here on, the two ends of the chain are complementary, are sticky ends. So you have these 16 base pairs that are complementary to each other at the end of the molecule. So if you let this molecule, if you let these two ends meet each other, eventually they form the hydrogen bonds and they form a circle. It's important to remember that you are going to have always these two breaks in the backbone. Okay? But basically in this system, we can form a circle very easily. In fact, this was done in the Cosarelli lab when they were performing cyclization experiments. So what they did in these experiments, they extracted the DNA from the bacteriophages. Then they heated the samples. So when you heat the samples, you break the hydrogen bonds. So you convert these molecules into linear molecules. Those knots disappear. And then they let those same molecules become cyclic again. So what they observed was the following. Well, they observed that they had mainly unknots and a 3% amount of knots. From these 3%, you have mostly trefoils, just a few four-crossing knots, and then just a few fives. Okay, they couldn't quantify whether they were torus, toroidal, or twist knots. But this is basically what happens when you allow P4 DNA molecules become cyclic in free solution. Okay, so this is our baseline. So we always have knots, at least about 3%, and they are going to be mainly trefoils. Now, the situation changes dramatically when you extract the DNA from the capsid, you don't let the knots break, and you run those knots in a gel. So here you see the percentage that we have. So for tailless mutants, which are these viruses without tail, we have about 95% knots, so it's pretty much the opposite to what you have on the other experiment. And then we have about 2% knots and 3% linear. They become linear during processing. So here is the gel that corresponds to this histogram. So these are the knots. You'll have the open circle here, the linear here, and all these are going to be the knots. So you basically see a smear. When you heat up the sample, as I said before, then you break all the knots, and then all these will disappear, as is shown here. Now, what we did was to also take the same sample, which is the first line over here, and treat it with topoisomerase at different time points and see how the distribution of knots would change. So if you see here, we have the initial configuration, the initial distribution of knots. Then we have, in line 2, treatment with topoisomerase. So we see they are not increasing. Then we have this thicker band, the trefoil, so on and so forth. Here we have the linear, and then this keeps going. And by looking at this gel, we basically can quantify that we have trefoil, 4-crossing knots, so on and so forth, 10-crossing knots. So we can estimate, if you extrapolate linearly, that these knots over here, the higher concentration of knots, might contain between 20 and 30 crossings, if not more. So if when we quantify these bands, what we see is that about 2% of the nodes are in between 3 and 10 crossings, and then we have a large percentage of nodes with high number of crossings. Again, but this is extrapolation. We don't really know how many nodes, how many crossings we have in these nodes over here. Now, it's important to remark that this is not a, kind of a secondary effect of the tailless mutants. We can create these tailless mutants and get the DNA if we take capsids, which means that when we take these mature phages and we process them, sometimes the tail is released from the capsid. We extract the DNA from that capsid, and we still see a large percentage of knots. Okay, so this is the knots that we see are not an artifact of the tailless of being tailless. And also, if we go farther and we take and we look at the DNA from mature phages, we see about 50% knots. So presumably, this is kind of an optimal way to obtain knots, but you could basically perform the same studies here. So what we can conclude from here is that knots, because of the distribution and the knotting probability, knots are formed inside the capsid or soon after the disruption. So it's possible that you disrupt the capsid and then the twins meet each other, but you still have this information present. And then we believe that they should provide information not only about the tailless but also about the mature phages. So the questions now that we want to ask, given that the knots are formed inside and that they can be used presumably to study how the DNA packs in the virus, so we want to ask what is the knotting probability, why so high the knotting probability, and why are the knots so complicated? So to answer these questions, we turn to computers and ask if we could do computer simulations of basically freely joined chains in confined volumes. So the reason why we picked this model was because it's fairly simple to work with. Biologists accept the freely joined chain. We know that it's not going to be very realistic in the sense that we don't have persistent length, but after all, we don't know what persistent length means under these conditions. So it's kind of an open question, what is the value of the persistent length here? The way we randomize these freely joined chains is using the crankshaft algorithm that probably most of the people know here. You select two points at random. These two points define an edge or an axis, and then you can rotate any of these two parts around each other. When you repeat that multiple times, that defines a Markov chain, and that Markov chain was shown to be ergodic by Ken. Then in order to put this into the capsid, or into this sphere, what we have to do is to define an energy on this polygon that basically forces the polygon to be inside the sphere, and then we use rejection method for whatever polygon is not inside the capsid. Okay, so we perform this Markov chain with this penalty, and every so often we sample, and whatever conformation is not inside the capsid, we reject it, or inside the sphere, we reject it. We recently worked on a model that was proposed also by Ken, which is called the uniform random polygon. This is very unrealistic, but it's a lot faster. The idea of this is that you take a cube, and then you start throwing points at random in here, and then you connect them up. So we know it's very unrealistic because the flexibility of this chain is not well-defined, unless you take the limit case. The good thing about this model is that we can actually prove theorems, or we think we can prove some theorems. So we can... It can be a good guide for what the theory should be for this problem. As you are going to see, the numbers are not quite the same. They are very similar to what you obtain with the other model. So qualitatively, they are basically equivalent. This is what I was referring to. So we take a curve, we put it inside a sphere, and then we want to know what are the most probable conformations inside a sphere of a given curve. And what we see is that when you put a curve inside a sphere of radius, let's say 5, then we have a higher probability, and this probability is going to increase with the chain length. That makes sense, correct? So if you put a very long chain inside a small sphere, then the knotting probability is going to increase. Also, if you decrease the radius, then we'll see how the knotting probability is going to increase. So the smaller the radius, the higher the knotting probability. So we performed these studies and were recently improved a lot by Micheletti and all, and they came up with a scaling formula that corresponds to this knotting probability. We don't know what would be, we know what would be the theorem that goes behind this, but we don't know how to prove it yet. Anyway, so if you look at the uniform random polygon, it's a very similar behavior, and you can also estimate what is the knotting probability for this type of polygons. Now, we say that the knotting probability is high, and we say that the knots in the bacteriophages are very complex. Remember that the average crossing number could be 30 or more. So what we did was we looked at the average crossing number of these polygons that we generated, and we see kind of a similar behavior as what I explained before. So the longer the chain, the more complex then the knot is going to be, or the smaller the radius of the sphere, also the more complex the knot is going to be. So we see this. We think we might have a proof for this, at least on that this grows as n squared with n the chain length. And definitely for this model, it's very simple. It comes up just almost by definition that goes with n squared. So in this case, kind of this model helps us to understand this model a little bit better. Anyway, so from this was all published, and what we claim in these studies was that computer simulations reveal that curves in confined volumes are going to be knotted with high probability, and that the knots we are going to find are going to be very complex. Therefore, we claim that the confinement is a key player in the formation of knots. Okay. So just because you have knots in a very small volume, then the knotting probability is going to be high. However, there is some data that was published in the 80s that doesn't quite fit that idea. In this data, let's see what is going to happen. So when you have no deletion, these are mature phages, so phages with bacteriophages with tail and with capsid and tail. When they look at the probability of knotting for this particular bacteriophage, they found that the knotting probability was 0.5. When they deleted 650 base pair, then the knotting probability went up, kind of contrary to what we saw, 0.5. And when they deleted 1,000 base pairs, even it went farther up. Okay? So it goes contrary to what I just told you. So we couldn't really figure out what to do with this for a while. But in order to better analyze and get more information from these knot distributions, what we did was to run two-dimensional gels. This was explained very nicely just today. So what we're going to do is we're going to run the gel in this dimension at very low voltage, and for many hours, and then in this other dimension, a high voltage and just for 4 hours. Okay, so you run the gel in this dimension, then you turn 90 degrees and run it in the other dimension. So what we see is this characteristic bell over here. Forget about these blue lines over here. The main feature here is that you have the AND knot on top. Then the linear is moved away from the sample, which is key to be able to read this bell over here. And then we see the different knots here. And we can pretty much determine all this, but we still see this smear. Okay? So if we blow up this region on top and quantify that, what we see is that we have, this is the AND knot, we have trefoils. We basically have no four crossing knots. Then we have 5, which is toroidal 5. Then 6s, 7s, 8, and so on and so forth. So this is what you see here is a knot ladder, and this is used to compare knots. So this is our sample, and this is something that people already know, that we already know what they are. So we have the trefoil here, migrates with this spot over here, the four crossing knot that is missing, the 5 toroidal, that is this knot, the 5 twist, that is the one on the ladder, and is missing here, The six, we have two populations. We don't know exactly what they are. And then the seven, for instance, we see the toroidal, but we don't see the twist. So we quantify this, and what we see is kind of a relevant feature, which is that four crossing knots don't have are basically missing, as well as twist knots. So what we thought was that one of the properties of the four crossing knot is that it's an achiral knot. So it's basically it's.
Sorry, do you know it's 6-3 in your accounting?
We don't know. We don't know. Yeah, this. Yeah, the number of knots you have here is very small. So even if you try to extract this from the sample, that would be tough. So what I was saying is that we have the four, one of the properties of the four crossing knot is an achiral knot. That means that it's equal to its mirror image. So you can take this knot and deform it and get the mirror image of the knot. One of the properties of these knots is that the writhe is zero. So I don't know if you're familiar with the writhe, but basically with the writhe, the way you compute the writhe is you take a projection and then you travel the knot, and then at every crossing you assign either a plus sign or a minus sign, and then you add them up. That would be the writhe in a particular direction, and then you average that value over all possible projections, and that will give you the actual writhe. So the writhe is going to measure how much the knot is deviating from the plane. So you have, for crossing knot, the writhe is going to be zero. For toroidal knots, the writhe is going to be very high. So we did kind of an ad hoc simulation and say, well, what is going to happen with our random samples when we put this writhe parameter? Meaning we are going to generate random configurations inside the sphere, and then we are going to reject anything that is below certain writhe. So when we did that, we observed something that reproduces what the experiments are doing, are showing. So it's basically we can kill, when we increase the writhe value, we kill the four crossing knots, we increase the toroidal, and we kind of decrease the five crossing knots. Okay? The twist knots. So again, this is already published, and the thing that is not quite published yet is this. And the idea is that when we go back and look at the knotting probability, we ask what is going to happen with the knotting probability when we increase the writhe a lot. And what we saw was kind of surprising, which is that first, if you have a fixed length and then you increase the writhe, then you start having higher knotting probability. And I'll explain you why we think that is in a minute. But what is more important is that when you have a higher, a longer chain length, the knotting probability is going first to decrease and then to start increasing again. So what we think is happening in here is that when we put high writhe in very short molecules, then the only way the molecule can achieve a high writhe is by knotting itself, by performing strand passage and knotting itself. On the other hand, when you have a longer molecule, what the longer molecule can do is start adding twist in this way. So in that way, the knotting probability kind of gets relaxed at this stage, and then at this other stage, basically this just is just like if you have a regular chain, we think. So in this sense, the idea of the writhe is that P4 reveal a chiral organization quantified by the writhe, and we believe that high writhe is consistent at the moment with all available information. Okay. Because remember that this high writhe is allowing us to decrease knotting probability with longer chain lengths. So now I'm going to the second part of the talk. I don't know if there are any questions about this. No? Yes?
Increasing length number, so it's compensated by it. Higher rise, but with higher rise, the probability of the 4-1 knot is decreasing.
If the chain is long enough, it will increase the high rise in that sense, as you are thinking. So, but if it's not short enough that you cannot put this extra twist, this rider master moves one, then it will knot itself. Okay. That's what we think is happening. And that, at the moment, that's the only explanation we have for why the knotting probability is going down. Sorry?
What trivial knot, zero rise has a meaning, but because of this,
anyway, comes from. Yes. Yes.
I have an alternative explanation.
Uh huh.
What if you need the whole length to plaster and be like a glue ace on the side of the thing? And if you fix that end, then you're not going to be able to go teasing through and make, you know, it won't be loose enough to go in and tie these torus knots. And the shorter it goes, the less it's glued on the toward the tail, right? And so it's more floppy and it can go and tease in. You know, it was like when Peter did that green ball, right?
Mm-hmm. It's like the glue is only the glue would be only at the end of the tail, so that doesn't really matter.
Then deletions at other places.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. These are deletions. These are.
Kills my mind.
Yeah. Well, good. It's good to have different views. So anyway, so that's the first part. So what we claim is that by looking at these knot distributions, we don't know what the global organization is going to be, but we claim it's going to be chiral, and that chirality given by the writhe, and the writhe is presumably going to be very high. Okay, so now we're going to take another approach. So we are going to look at what other people have been doing and see what is the knotting distribution that these models give. So biologists have been working on DNA packing in bacteriophages for ages, and they have proposed a number of models. We proposed this random model, but I'm not going to talk about this now. One of the most popular models today is the spooling model. Basically, you have this spooling and not spoiling, as we were saying today at lunch. We have this DNA kind of winding around this axis, and you can think that this is the axis as I show in the first figure, where the DNA is packed. You can have also toroidal models, so similar to this, but the DNA would basically lay around or along the toroid. This toroid could also fold in three dimensions later. Then another model could be this fold model, in which the DNA goes in as a straight line, and then it hits the end of the capsid and bends very sharply. And then this liquid crystal model that is a favorite for physicists, and which I haven't been able to still really grasp. But basically what this is telling you is that you have local organization, but not so global organization of these ones. So basically, if you talk to a physicist, then he tells you that all this is nonsense. And if you talk to a biologist, he will tell you that this is nonsense. So I guess there should be somewhere in between. That is true. Anyway, so when people look at the reconstruction of EMs, what they see across different bacteriophages are these concentric rings. So these are different type of phages, all with tails and so on. And they see these concentric rings. And when they do the reconstructions, they claim that these are going to be these toroidal or spooling strands. Now, you see that it's highly ordered in the center, but it's highly disorganized in the middle. So we try to look at this, and also Steve Harvey did it on his own, using molecular dynamics and minimization algorithms. So basically, you generate these spooling models, and then you try to close the ends and ask what is going to happen. So when we did this, and when Steve Harvey kind of went further and studied this model, they found basically no knots. Okay? So if you take this as well organized as is shown in here, and you try to close the ends, you basically see no knots. So what we proposed was a model in which we randomized this spooling conformation. Okay, you can think that it doesn't have to go all the way to the out, to the periphery, but it can be more in the inside. That strands, instead of going very nicely and organized, they can kind of go around each other and they can somehow link around each other. So we propose this algorithm. This algorithm has three parameters: the radius of the large sphere, the radius of this tube over here that basically would represent kind of this tube that you saw at the beginning, like the packing proteins, and this H, which is a random bias. So let me show you how this... algorithm works. So we did these simulations in Notplot, and so what you can see is that we can grow the chain, and then the chain can have either go up or go down, and then it starts growing within the sphere. And then eventually what we do is we close the two ends over here. But the main point here, let me see if I get a good projection. Is that fibers can get in and out from this. I'll show you some in a minute. But fibers can get in and out. So they're not as well organized as their people are proposing for the other packing models. So, and you see, at the moment, we are closing this in a cheap way, which is once we finish this spooling conformation, we just close that. So we know that we are going to make some errors there. But it's worth attempting this. Anyway, so let me go back to the talk. So we generated these polygons. So here you see how, for instance, if we have so this is a sphere of radius 1 with a smaller cylinder inside of radius 8, a smaller cylinder of radius 1, and a randomization of 0.1. So then you see that the chain tends to be kind of close to the center, so it doesn't expand too much. If we increase this random parameter a little bit more, then we can kind of fill all the sphere. We can see, for instance, that for smaller radii, we can basically fill the whole sphere. And then we see also that the packing doesn't have to be very well organized. So you can have regions where you have the DNA is more extended or the curve is more extended, and here regions where there is more condensed. So when you add a certain randomization, what it's going to imply is that you are not going to have kind of such a nice organized way. So you can have regions that are more condensed, regions that are less condensed. So these are similar images, and you see how it fills the capsid. And just to give you an idea how complex these knots get, you can look at this figure. So you can see how the fibers keep interlacing with each other in this situation. So they can get the knots that we are seeing are very complicated. So when we quantify this, we see that first, if we take a very h equals 0.1, then we see that the radius of gyration is very small, which I showed before. And in this situation, the sphere wouldn't be making any difference when we generate this polygon. So there is no pressure from the sphere. However, when we increase h to 0.3 or 0.5, then we see how we are filling the whole sphere, and then we start filling the confinement of the sphere. So that's a parameter we kind of are playing with to understand this. Now, the knotting probability goes up for when we have smaller h. So here you have the different knotting probability up to 300 segments, and you see that for h equals 0.1, the knotting probability is higher. When we really confine this into very tight volumes, then we see this yellow curve here, and we can go... This corresponds to radius 2, and this other corresponds to 5 and 8. So here you see how it doesn't really matter how big this radius is because the effect is not large, but once we decrease the radius, then we really increase the knotting probability. So the good thing about this model is we reach saturation very fast. And another good thing is that we can prove theorems. So here... We can use the idea of safer circles. The idea of these safer cycles are the following. You take a projection of the knot, and then for the projection of the knot, you at each crossing, you are going to change every crossing like this into a crossing like that, or a non-crossing like that. So all this is divided into these different circles. Those are called safer cipher circles. Now, you can prove a lemma that tells you that the number of times that the DNA or that the curve spools around this capsid is equal to the number of safer cycles. Then, using a theorem by Norton, then we can say that if the writhe is larger than the rounding number or the number of safer cycles, then the knot is going to be non-trivial and it cannot be a chiral. So this is a theorem that is in part of this spooling type of conformation. Also, we can look at the average crossing number. The average crossing number is going to the square, and we can basically prove another theorem that tells you that the average crossing number, the average number of crossings in the xy plane, so basically in the spooling direction, grows as the order of n squared. So finally, we compare this, although these simulations haven't been finished yet, with the data that we found. So remember that in the experimental data, we found that we have trefoils, we have no crossing knots, four crossing knots. We have five ones, which were the toroidal, and almost no twists. So here in this model, we find that we can decrease the four crossing knots, and we can increase the toroidal knots and decrease also the twist knots. So we have the right trend, although we are not there yet. So let me finish by, well, kind of the conclusions. So going from here to the model, we don't know how the DNA is organized, but we claim that it's going to be chirally organized and the right is going to be high. And going from the models that people have proposed to here, then we are proposing this spooling model that is not so deterministic but has this random component into it that, again, might not be for the whole entire capsid, but it might be more for the center of the capsid. So to acknowledge a number of people, so this project was started with the Witt Sumners and with Joaquin Roca in Spain. We collaborated with Steve Harvey and the image that I showed. Now we are collaborating with Joanne and Diao. At San Francisco State, we have this very bright student, Trevor Blackstone, who did a number of simulations, an undergraduate student. Then Marielle and Rob Sharain. And this summer, I had the opportunity to work in math camp for a week. This is a camp, a math camp for 15, 16-year-old who are taking basically graduate courses in math. So they are very smart kids and very willing to do anything. So they've been working with me now at long distance, generating some of the images that you've been seeing. And I was really impressed. I mean, these are kids that you can talk about group actions and double branch cyclic covers, and they are all excited, and it's amazing. So anyway, all this is funded by NIH, and this is all. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? I liked your random model.
You like?
And okay, you just abandoned it completely. But when you look really carefully at the electron micrograph images, they're not in the outer shells. They're really not crossing
not
ever. I mean, you can follow it as much as you can see, and it never crosses. Mm-hmm. So how about a mixed model?
Yeah,
where you fill the shell, and it's perfect, and everything is all mm-hmm. rigid and perfect, and then chaos happens. Mm-hmm. There's this thing, and then it's your random model again.
That's what I think is happening. Yeah, correct. Okay. It might be also that when in the electron micrographs, you don't fully reconstruct. Like, if you have a random fiber crossing, you wouldn't see it, I think. I don't have I don't have experience with that, but let me see. So here. So here you see, you see these cells. I mean, it might be possible that a strand is going by. I mean, it's crossing from one level to another. But basically, it's possible. What I think is, for instance, once the DNA, once you go to a level where the persistent length of the DNA is larger than this volume here, then you have to start kind of playing maybe some random. So it might be that.
Javier, among the models you considered, the second one was toroidal one, mm-hmm. and it looked like it should be very effective in doing knots. So
it's also very effective.
Have you looked into this?
This our model, somehow, depending on the parameters you choose, you can generate toroids or you can generate more spooling conformation depending on the parameters. And yes, you see, I mean, you saw this. You saw this one. Mm-hmm. It's just the crossing here is just insane.
Okay, but if you would be doing it systematically, it would be even more effective in doing knots.
Presumably.
Yeah.
Just with a random path.
They would be like the torus knots, which have a very high rise.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what we hope. But you see, these knots are very complicated. So even computing delta of -2, it's it's kind of a mess.
Yes. I have two questions. One is on this model again. No? So I was trying just to... So you say that you have parameters H.
Yeah.
And that... so can you tell me a little bit the physical, the meaning it would be?
So the H would be kind of the direction where, like, when we grow the chain, so you allow certain randomness on where to go. So instead of kind of minimizing the angle at every single step, you would allow certain deviation.
Okay,
from that
so
minimum.
It's probably... So am I right? So the axis of the spool is fixed, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So this liquid crystal model, as you say, this physicist model, sometimes we see in simulation that the spool axis is a bit random as well. So could you put it in the model, you think? Or?
I think, yes.
That could change the...
It might... I don't think things will change that much. I mean, if you mean change it during the simulation?
Just if it is like in a liquid crystal, it means that it's more or less aligned, but there could be very large... deviation on the size of the
I think it would be better for us.
Okay.
I mean, it will be more accord to the...
Yeah.
The model that I presented is kind of the basic, the most basic thing we could think of.
And then the last question was about the experiment. Mm-hmm. So I was just curious if you can... Because in principle, at least in simulation, the buffer can change a bit the structure. So do you know in the P4, if you can say... So tell us something about the buffer, if it is, because if there is multivalent ions, there could be attractions, and perhaps if there are monovalent, it's only repulsive.
Interestingly, the simulations that were done by the Cosarelli group have the same, I mean, not the simulations, but the experiments that were done by them in free solution have the same salt condition.
Same salt.
So that's good. So now, if you change, if you start to mess with the ions, then you might blow up the capsid.
So it should be monovalent, right?
So you have to be careful with that. I'm not sure exactly what is the range under which the viruses are okay. Now, one experiment that was suggested to me is that we add PEG to the solution. So PEG would be confining. So even though you explode, then PEG would be still be there, kind of confining the whole thing. And that might be something to try. But I don't know how hard then is cleaning the DNA from the PEG and everything.
Yeah, Javier, for the spooling model, can you say anything about the growth of the knot complexity? I mean, a crossover number in a projection grows like the square. Mm-hmm. Are there any other issues in knot complexity that you have
something
about?
This data actually corresponds to the average crossing number, overall projections.
Right, so it's not...
So it goes... We have as a x n square, although the power is very small. So I'm not sure exactly whether we can generalize the theorem as n square or not. It's still pending.
Other questions? Okay, so let's thank both speakers again.
Thank you.